Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. Coming up on our program today, Biden's plan to kill Keystone XL.
This is about tens of thousands of jobs here. This is about billions of dollars of revenue. It's important that in the next 48 hours that Prime Minister Trudeau reach out directly to the incoming administration to reiterate the message he sent on November the 9th, that this is at the top of the agenda, that this is central to the bilateral relationship.
President-elect Joe Biden plans to use an executive order to kill the controversial pipeline on his first day in office, sources tell CTV News. Can Canada do anything to stop it? What will the economic fallout be? In moments, we're going to speak to the Saskatchewan Premier, Scott Moe. We got MPs here to debate this and lots more. And then the heavy toll of vaccine delays.
The impact is huge. It goes from 20% reduction up to 50%. That's going to be a massive, massive impact. And if you go back to the beginning of this, and this was our concern at the beginning.
Provinces across the country are shifting vaccination plans now that Pfizer deliveries will be slashed over the next month. How will provinces manage the supply slowdown and get ready for the second wave as it keeps cresting? Ontario just opened its first new hospital in 30 years, starting out dedicated to COVID. The Vaughan mayor will join us. The hospital is in his city, and he'll be on the press gallery to talk about that. Plus, America locks down.
So every guardsman takes an oath, and it's to defend the Constitution from enemies foreign and domestic. And as we've seen, sometimes the enemies are a little closer to home.
Officials are now vetting thousands of National Guard members in Washington, D.C. to protect Joe Biden's administration to make sure none of them support far-right rioters. How many threats are actually facing the administration on Inauguration Day? We'll bring you the latest from Washington, D.C., from CTV's Annie Bergeron. Oliver, she is there. This is Power Play. Let's get to those players. So President Joe Biden is set to scrap the Keystone XL pipeline extension. The president-elect is widely expected to shut down the extension on his very first day in office. The cross-border extension is supposed to deliver 830,000 barrels of oil a day from Alberta down to Nebraska and then on down through the southern United States. The premiers of Saskatchewan and Alberta have already condemned the reports, calling on the federal government to take action. Both provinces are already committed to keeping the fight up for the project. The federal minister of natural resources, Seamus O'Regan, who, by the way, we asked to join us today, but he said he was unavailable, did send out a statement saying the federal government will continue to, quote, make the case for the pipeline and that the government's support for the Keystone XL project is longstanding and well known. Look, the truth is, this comes as no surprise. Joe Biden has long been promising to rescind the permit through an executive order. He's been wanting to kill this pipeline for a long time. It's been a key campaign promise. It's the speed of this that has caught some politicians off guard. On his first day in office, he's going to do this. No dialogue, no debate. Again, though, there's some precedent for this. The pipeline, you might remember, was spiked the first time by then President Barack Obama just 3 days after Justin Trudeau formally became the prime minister back in 2015. Now, with just 2 days before Joe Biden's first day in office, how does Canada's government fight for a pipeline? We begin our coverage with the Saskatchewan Premier, Scott Moe, who joins us. Premier, again, Jason Kenney had that statement earlier today saying you got to fight for it. What more can the federal government or your government or the Alberta government do to make sure Joe Biden doesn't kill this pipeline?
Well, this is concerning that this is happening on day one of ultimately what would be a President Biden administration. And what we need to do at the highest levels and with the full weight of the federal government and the prime minister of this nation is to make the case for this piece of infrastructure that benefits not only Canadians and not only Americans, but benefits all of North America as a whole. It provides energy security. It provides ultimately jobs on both sides of the border today, as well as in its operation in years to come. And you know, there is an environmental piece to this pipeline, unlike any other pipeline that I'm aware of, that needs to that case needs to be made to the Biden administration as well. And it's our hope that that the Biden administration will listen as to the merits of why this pipeline is necessary, why this pipeline is positive for all of us in North America.
you know, Premier Mo Hope is in the strategy, as you know, and Joe Biden, he has promised to kill this for a long time. He's got a base that doesn't want this. Barack Obama didn't want this. The case has been made for years. James Rajat has been the representative of Alberta in Washington. The prime minister has talked about this. In other words, they've done a lot to advocate for this. It doesn't seem to have made a difference to Joe Biden. He's making this a top priority. What more could they have done, if anything?
Well, the approvals have been made as well by the previous U.S. administration, and there are currently Americans that are working on this pipeline in the U.S. as well as in people working on it on the Canadian side as well. So this is a positive project. Our federal government needs to continue to make that case. We're reaching out at the provincial level in much the same way as we did when we were working our way through the modernization of our trade agreement with the U.S., where it was all hands on deck. The federal government was there using all of the tools that they have and all of the connections that they have. The provincial governments were also there in the months leading up to ultimately the modernization of NAFTA and the signing of the USMCA. This is going to have to happen much, much quicker. And it's our hope that a Biden administration is most certainly going to listen to the merits of why this is an important piece of infrastructure for North America. Listen, the demand is still there. The refinery is still going to be working in the Gulf Coast. The choice is whether to buy a relatively sustainable product from a friendly nation like Canada with a secure supply line through the Keystone XL, or continue to barge the energy in from a place like Venezuela or one of the OPEC nations.
Right. And their own production is going up there, as you know. Tell me about the cost. If they do cancel this, if he does rescind it, first of all, is the project dead, or are there ways through NAFTA, dispute resolution ways, that would take a long time, or lawsuits that you could have some recourse?
Well, ultimately, the hope is that the relationship that Canada and the U.S. have, and that our Prime Minister and President-elect Biden have, is that they're able to actually have a conversation around the merits of a project like this. If we're not able to, that'd be very concerning. As the first step of a new administration in the U.S. is to rescind approvals that have already been put forward, and really send people home that are working on this pipeline currently, as well as those that would hope to throughout its operation in the decades ahead. Certainly, that would be concerning for all of us in North America to have our Canada-U.S. relations start off on that type of a footing.
How much money would your province lose? Jason Kenney, his province invested $1 billion plus in this. They could lose that money if this is rescinded. What could be the costs of that?
Well, the cost to Saskatchewan would be to our energy industry. We also have energy that's in that pipeline, energy that has reduced their carbon footprint by 50% over the course of the recent number of years. That's some of the most sustainable energy in the world. That would be going in a pipeline that ultimately would be a net zero on its own energy emissions in its operation. But we stand to lose to our energy industry here in the province about $1 billion, and that's in the oil differential in addition to the direct loss of the energy that would ultimately be in that pipeline. So about $1 billion at least a year, and that's going off of last year, which was a fairly skinny year for the energy industry given a global pandemic. So it could be far north of that in the years ahead, and that's just in the price differential of not having access to sufficient pipeline capacity, of which KXL is part of the solution to that.
Just real quick, Jagmeet Singh and Annamie Paul from the Green Party, they both oppose this pipeline, as you know. They say it's time to have a, quote, transition to more sustainable industries. What do you say to the detractors of the pipeline who said this is the environmental impact's too big and there's no place for this pipeline? Joe Biden's among them, Jagmeet Singh's, Barack Obama was the same. What do you say to them?
They don't have all of the information. The fact is the refinery is still going to operate down on the Gulf Coast, but they're going to use oil from Venezuela or from one of the OPEC nations that has much higher greenhouse gas emissions than the energy that's coming in, at least from Saskatchewan, into the KXL pipeline. Most certainly, this is a positive pipeline for North American energy security. It's a positive pipeline for jobs today and into the future for all North Americans. And it has a very strong environmental story to tell, dumping some of the most energy energy, some of the most sustainable energy in at one end, going to a refinery right. and preventing some of that much dirtier energy from coming across the ocean on a barge to be used in that very same refinery. So the not building this pipeline actually is a net negative and a step backwards for climate change and for greenhouse gas emissions globally.
Premier, just while I've got you, I want to quickly talk about COVID. Saskatchewan now is got the worst cases per capita. So things have gone badly now. Why not implement more restrictions? Is that on the table as your cases keep going up?
Well, yeah, our cases have went up post-Christmas. They're starting to reduce again. Now we're down about 10% on our seven-day rolling average here right now. And we do have significant measures in place here in the province, not quite as much as maybe some other areas, but more than some as well. So we do have significant measures in place that we're working in the lead up to the holiday season. They seem to be working again now. As I said, our seven-day rolling average is starting to decrease. We also have a little bit of a backlog in our active case numbers. And so in the next day or two, I would look for some of our active cases to actually be removed from where we are in our reporting, as there seems to be some degree of a backlog there. So our active cases are starting to come down, and we're happy to see that not only stabilize, but come down. And we expect that to continue in the weeks ahead.
Well, first of all, we hope so. We all Absolutely. Hope so. Premier Moe, great to have you on the program. I appreciate it.
Take care, Evan.
All right, so Joe Biden is set to hurt the oil sector on his first day in office. That's what the report is. Again, not surprising news. He's long promised to kill Keystone XL. Again, it's the speed of it just on his first day. Any way to stop him? Could the federal government have done more? Or should they do more? The Alberta Premier, Jason Kenney, is calling on the Prime Minister to urgently reach out to the President-elect, demand that he at least show Canada, quote, the respect of sitting down and discussing the move. But will this put a major wedge in U.S.-Canada relations? Again, Barack Obama spiked it, and that didn't seem to hurt the relationship, but it did hurt the Canadian economy. Let's bring in some MPs for this debate. The Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Natural Resources, Paul Lefebvre, is here. Conservative Natural Resources Critic Greg McLean is here. And the Natural Resource Critic for the NDP, Richard Cannings, is here. And so is the Green Party leader, Annamie Paul. Great to have all of you here. Mr. Lefebvre, let me just start with you.
Sure.
There's lots of calls for your government to reach out to the Biden administration. Has the Prime Minister spoken to Joe Biden about this? And is there any, what is the strategy to stop Joe Biden from canceling a pipeline your government says you support?
Certainly, Evan, this is certainly speculation right now, certainly. But as you said, certainly this is not new for the Biden administration, but our support for this infrastructure is not so surprising either. The Prime Minister has been advocating for this for the past 7 years. And in his first conversation with the Biden administration, he actually voiced his support again. So at the officials level, I know we have been having a lot of conversation. As you know, the current administration is still there until Wednesday. But again, as I said, we are having conversations at the officials level. We continue to engage right. and to share why this is very important to Canada.
Okay, but let me just ask you, can you confirm your government clearly thinks it's going to be canceled on the first day? Outside of advocacy, is there any other method that you can do or your government will do to advocate for this? Because you don't have a lot of time.
Well, certainly we've been advocating, as you said, and we're going to continue to have those conversations. And we still believe in this infrastructure, in this pipeline. We believe that we can meet our climate goals by 2030, our Paris climate goals, and as well as our net zero goals by 2050, and still support this. We believe that, and the Biden administration is all on record to say that they believe that oil and gas will still be used for decades to come. We are making the case that it should be Canadian oil and gas that is at the forefront, which is the strongest environmentally and the climate, the strongest frameworks on climate policy in the G7, and we believe in the world. So we're going to continue to make the case, and we will see what happens certainly on Wednesday or in the future.
Mr. McLean, what's your response? Jason Kenney has been on record commending the federal government on how they've advocated for this. It doesn't seem to make it much difference, though. What more, in your view, could the federal government be doing?
Well, first of all, I appreciate Mr. Lefebvre's comments on how much the federal government's officials are working on this. What I think has to happen at this point in time is the Prime Minister has to get directly involved in this and call up Mr. Biden himself, potentially even fly down to see him and make sure that he understands the implications this has for North American energy security, greenhouse gas production and actually jobs in both our countries going forward. That's something that should be happening right now.
Fly down, although, okay, we'll find out if it's the first meeting. I don't know if there's time to have a meeting before the inauguration. I mean, this is the thing. If it's the first day, it's really interesting. Now, the NDP, let me bring in the NDP. Richard Canning, your party does not support this. I guess, what is the case against it, given the fact that you've got Alberta's economy is hurting badly? It's going to cost them $1 billion. The same with Saskatchewan. And I understand your party has talked a lot about a transition, but the transition is slow. For a lot of workers, they're just transitioning to try to make their next month's mortgage payment. What's the case against this pipeline?
Well, the case, I mean, for instance, the Canadian Energy Regulator just put out a report just before Christmas that said, given the state of the world oil economy, given the fact that we are moving in that direction, investment is moving in the direction of a new economy, a cleaner economy, that if we do anything to tackle climate change, both Keystone XL and Trans Mountain won't be needed. We're trying to export oil into a world that's awash in cheap oil and a world where oil demand is decreasing. And I feel sorry for Albertans that Jason Kenney has, put billions of dollars into this project. I feel sorry for Canadians that Justin Trudeau has put billions of dollars into the Trans Mountain pipeline. These are pipelines that even the Canada Energy Regulator says we will not need. These are expansion pipelines. They're about, exporting more and more oil. Yes, we'll need oil for decades to come, but we won't need more and more oil. And that's the crux of this. We need to put those billions of dollars into a really bold program to create good jobs for these workers that are really hurting. And I feel that we're misleading them if we tell them, if only we had a pipeline, your jobs would magically appear again.
Well, okay, so let me bring in Anna Paul, the Green Party leader. What's your take on what Joe Biden's doing? You clearly support the decision, but how do you rationalize the economic impact? Anna Paul, we can't hear you. I'm going to give you a chance. I don't know if you're on mute, Anna Paul. Let me just make sure.
I was on mute, waiting to come online. Sorry about that. This week was really a contrast in leadership. The same week that we're learning that Biden, President-elect Biden, is canceling a pipeline, we also heard that our government was bringing three new drilling exploration projects online. And so I applaud President-elect Biden. I hope that he will hold his nerve because he is doing absolutely the right thing. And we knew for a long time that if President-elect Biden won the election, the presidential election, he was going to be canceling this project. And so what good leadership federally and provincially should have done was to plan for that and to plan for have a contingency. That hasn't happened. And that is really what is putting workers and people in Alberta and Saskatchewan at risk right now. And that is the true failure.
Yeah, but how do you rationalize, what do you tell these workers, though, who were working on a project that had already got the permits? Like it had been green, like the green light had come, they're working on it, they're building it. What do you tell them now that they're out of a job?
Well, first, I tell them that you've been let down by political leaders who put their own political futures and the needs of the oil and gas lobby ahead of yours. And when I say that, I'm talking to my brother, because my brother up until recently was a worker in the oil patch out in Alberta. And what he wants is a stable job without a boom and bust. He wants a future for himself. He wants a job that's going to be around in 5 or 10 years. And these are not those jobs. I was really encouraged when Premier Kenney announced his Economic Recovery Council and his plan to diversify the economy. But then he doubled down on this pipeline, knowing that the next government to come in the United States, the next administration, might not support it. So if we care about the future of workers in Alberta, it has to be about a green recovery with jobs that pay more, that are stable, and that have a future.
Let me just get Mr. McLean to respond to that. What do you say to Anna Paul, Mr. McLean?
Ms. Paul, is I understand what she's saying. However, let's look at the actual facts there, and I'll I'll go through this. We're talking about jobs here. We're talking about jobs where people have committed their work. This is a pipeline that's half built on a presidential permit going south. So there's a lot of jobs here. There's a lot of jobs in the United States where people actually have actually done a lot to get this moving along. And let's recognize as well, this is a greener pipeline than the one that was actually constructed by or planned by and rejected after 7 years by the previous president, President Obama. Sorry, am I coming through okay?
Yeah, you're coming through.
Maybe Evan. Yes. Can I respond to this, please? Yes, certainly.
First, leadership. Sure.
Thank you. Leadership is supporting good paying jobs and as well as meeting our climate targets. And that is what we are doing. And we believe that this project fits within that framework. We've been, again, since day one, supporting this. And as I said before, as the U.S. administration has said themselves, we will need require oil and gas for decades to come. We need to make sure that that oil and gas around the world is Canadian oil and gas. That's why we put the strictest ESG framework in the world here in Canada. The clean fuel standards, a price on pollution. We are doing more, I believe, certainly when it comes to climate change than the Biden climate plan. And at the same time, we are supporting those workers and we're supporting our energy sector.
Well, let's find out how it goes.
With the greatest of respect, you cannot claim to be a climate warrior government and to support fracking, to support putting more pipelines online, to support drilling exploration projects, to refuse to increase your targets. None of those things are compatible with any kind of climate leadership. And I think that people in Canada are starting to wake up to that. I would really encourage our Prime Minister not to use our political capital with the president who has clearly said he does not support this project and to focus on the kind of things we can do together, like carbon borders and building a green recovery and green jobs with the future.
Well, Ms. Paul, if I can interject there for one second.
We have 30 seconds real quick.
Okay, well, we're talking about oil primarily in this line. So it's mostly oil sands oil that's going to be shipped down to refineries in the United States that are going to be using heavy oil in any respect. This is cleanly produced Canadian oil from oil sands that's reduced its environmental footprint by over 20% in the last decade. There's no other oil on the planet that's had such a great environmental performance. So I challenge you on the science of what you're talking about there.
Challenge accepted.
Okay, unfortunately, I got to leave the discussion here, but believe me, this is an ongoing debate that we will continue to have. Mr. Lefebvre, great to have you on the program.
Thank
Mr.
you.
McLean, I'm sorry, I wish I had a little more chance to talk to you. Mr. Cannings as well. Annamae Paul, lots of good debate to have on this, but we'll find out what happens on Wednesday, the first day of the Biden administration. All right, we have to take a very short break, and we're going to talk about vaccine shortages in a minute. But first, Washington, D.C. has transformed into a fortress ahead of Inauguration Day. What are the threats they're facing? We'll give you the details next with Annie Bergeron-Oliver. Then we hit vaccine supply issues in Canada. Stay with us. Call the lockdown inauguration on Wednesday. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will be sworn in as the president and vice president of the United States. But it will look more like a pandemic war zone than a typical inauguration of celebration after the assault on Capitol Hill on January 6th. And amidst ongoing threats, security in Washington, D.C. and across the country is amped up. In Washington, D.C. alone, there are 25,000 National Guard troops descending on that Capitol to protect it. The FBI is even vetting service members to guard against internal threats. This after reports that some law enforcement officers may have been involved in the Capitol insurrection. Like, this is incredible stuff. What should we expect on Inauguration Day on Wednesday? CTV's Annie Bergeron-Oliver is in Washington. Annie, what kind of threats are they expecting and what kind of security prep is taking place there?
Well, first, we know a couple days ago, the FBI sent that memo to all of its security partners warning about armed rallies in all 50 states, including D.C. So that's obviously the biggest threats. They're worried that far right extremists may try to have some type of a violent rally or get together here in D.C. You know, we've heard from some of the airlines that they've seen more people trying to check weapons into their luggage en route to D.C. than they have seen ever before. So that's obviously concerning. And this is really why the security has been stepped up so much. As you said, 25,000 National Guards. In 2017, there were only about 7,800 National Guards, and I believe a total security force of about 20,000. Now we have 25,000 National Guards, plus thousands of other FBI agents, Capitol Police, New York PD. They're all here protecting it. You're seeing more fencing go up. We just had fencing go up near the office, big 10-foot fences with security guards outside checking our IDs just to come into the block near the office. So this is getting bigger every day, and it's definitely a city that's on edge, Evan.
Yeah, tell us a bit about the FBI screening their own service members for internal threats. What does that mean?
So, you know, for the National Guard, this could mean having members checked on FBI watch lists, run through databases. You know, some of the commanders are being told to keep an eye on their troops in the National Guard to see if there's any unusual behavior, any type of unusual talk. There's also training for National Guard members to try to learn what an insider threat might look like. And a lot of experts are saying this is really largely unprecedented, especially when it comes to domestic terrorism, which is what they're calling what happened at the riots, and what a lot of experts are looking for. So, you know, there's a lot going on in the National Guard. As you mentioned, the FBI is looking as well. Even DOJ announced earlier that they're looking internally to see, you know, if maybe some of their members contributed to that riot.
Yeah, just before I let you go, there's also COVID considerations. I remember 4 years ago, we all remember Donald Trump saying he had the biggest crowd ever. There's just how big can the crowds be between COVID and the security threats? Are we going to have like nine people lurking around?
So I heard a number, only about 200 people are actually going to be on the Capitol steps. That's normally where you would see thousands of people shoulder to shoulder, a lot of VIPs. The National Mall, where there was, you know, hundreds of thousands of people for Donald Trump, there won't be anyone. The National Mall is completely closed off. What they've done this year instead is put hundreds of thousands of flags from the different state and local governments. This is a way for the inauguration committee and, you know, the officials to say we're thinking about people, but they can't actually be there. So that'll be the biggest change, is that National Mall completely empty. Just flags, no people standing to shoulder as we've seen for decades.
Well, be some debate about who's got the most flags now. Annie Bergeron Oliver, great to have you back on the program. We'll have live coverage right here on CTV news channel of the inauguration throughout the day on Wednesday. You can watch our inauguration special, of course, hosted by CTV News chief anchor and senior editor Lisa LaFlamme from 10 in the morning Eastern, right here on CTV News channel and on the main CTV network and on ctvnews.ca. Coming up next, killing Keystone XL.
Surely the relationship between Canada and the United States is worth at least having that discussion.
Will Joe Biden move ahead with his promise to kill the cross-border pipeline? How should Canada respond? The press gallery is next. Our special guest is the former Premier of Saskatchewan, Brad Wall. Stay with us.
Now is the critical hour. We are at the 11th hour, and we need, if this really is a top priority, as it should be, then we need the Government of Canada to stand up for Canadian workers, for Canadian jobs, for the Canada-US relationship right now, today and tomorrow.
Okay, so that's the Alberta Premier Jason Kenney weighing in on reports that President-elect Joe Biden is going to revoke the Keystone XL pipeline permit on his first day in office. Again, I keep saying this, that's not shocking news. Joe Biden has made this a key campaign promise. He was part of the effort to block the project in the Obama era. Obama did it 3 weeks after Justin Trudeau took office. But the timing, though, is startling. It's the first day in office at a time when U.S.-Canadian relations could use some, well, some TLC. So how should the Liberal government respond, especially as they try to build support out west? The press gallery is here. Tonda McCharles is the senior reporter with the Toronto Star. And let me start with our special guest in this round is Brad Wall, the former premier of Saskatchewan and special advisor to Osterhoskin and Harcourt. Brad Wall, good to have you and Tonda on the program. Again, it's no surprise. Can you sort of calibrate, did the federal government, did Alberta and Saskatchewan, had they done enough leading up to this to make the case for the pipeline? And what can they do at this 11th hour?
Safe to say they have been, all of those actors have been working on this since the election in November. And by the way, I agree 100% on it. We should be surprised that this decision's coming, apparently coming from the new administration. But the timing, to have him do this right out of the hop on the very first day, you know, that is a bit of a surprise. But that notwithstanding, you know, we all know that in the U.S. system, after the election in early November, there's this sort of lame duck period in terms of the Congress that's there, where the president-elect basically sets up shop with his own team. The transition begins. And so it would surprise me if the folks that you've mentioned, the TC Energy, if provinces that have a lot of have a lot at stake in this, and if the federal government have not been working both behind the scenes. We know the federal government has been public in their, basically calling on the new Biden administration to reconsider this promise. I think if there's hope in this, it's that, you know, TC Energy has here very recently committed to making the pipeline's energy source emissions-free, emissions-neutral by 2030. They're talking about solar power and wind energy, renewable energy, to power the pipeline, spending over $1 billion to do it is their commitment. Maybe that's helped. Maybe that gives the U.S. administration pause, or it gives a chance for the Canadian government and TC Energy to come back to the administration after this decision, apparently, that's coming soon, to have them ask them to reconsider.
Yeah, and Tana, look, TC Energy's throwing the Hail Mary. We're going to make this a green pipeline. Of course, environmentalists call that an oxymoron, but they say, as Brad Wall says, $1.7 billion to make the operating system renewable energy, make it zero emissions by 2030. But what recourse, what outside of lobbying, which they've done, which has never really worked, Tonda, with the Democrats, what more can or should Justin Trudeau be doing?
Well, I just want to go back to Mr. Wall's point there about what the government was doing in the interim since Biden won the election. I mean, they've been very cautious, as has the Biden transition team. I'm told that the Trudeau people, whereas before they did a lot of outreach, in the early days before Trump was elected to connect to his people, there was, you'll recall, a lot of talk about whether Trump should have been dealing with any foreign countries' administrations before he was formally inaugurated. And so both the Biden transition team and the Trudeau people have been very careful not to breach those bounds. And so a lot of the actual connections have been on hold until Inauguration Day, notwithstanding the public call that Trudeau did make with Biden. And, you know, he came out and told the country that was one of the first things he raised. So the lobbying, the upfront lobbying, doesn't really get a chance to get going until they're formally installed, is my understanding, although they've been trying to build bridges with the Biden team through other channels. So look, what recourse does the federal government have, or Jason Kenney? Can they use NAFTA to contest that kind of a decision once it comes down? Look, I'm not sure that will happen. In fact, maybe Biden's doing Trudeau a favor by ripping the Band-Aid off in the first day or the first week of his administration and getting underway, because he's made clear, as you said, that this was his intention all along.
Brad Wall and Tanya McCharles, just hold on. I want to stay in Alberta, but I want to go to Dina Hinshaw to get the latest COVID update. Then we'll return.
I appreciate
to talk more about the pipeline.
Tremendous pressure as COVID-19 case counts in hospital have been high over the past several months. And I want to thank you for your work. Turning to today's numbers, due to a technical issue, our website will not be updated until later today. We will post our usual dashboard of information as soon as possible. Over the last 24 hours, we have identified 474 new cases of COVID-19 and completed about 8,500 tests. The positivity rate is about 5.4%. There are currently 739 people in hospital, including 120 who have been admitted to the ICU. Sadly, 11 new deaths were reported to us in the last 24 hours. While it is encouraging to see these numbers are going down, it is important to keep in mind that over the past 10 years, the average annual recorded death toll from influenza has been 58 deaths per year. So having lost an additional 11 people to COVID-19, which amounts to almost 20% of an average full year of influenza data, should not be taken lightly. The lives lost to COVID-19 are a painful reminder to us all of the seriousness of the virus and the need to protect ourselves and each other from it. Earlier today, the Premier noted that the first dose vaccinations have been provided to residents and staff at all 357 long-term care and designated supportive living facilities in Alberta. I know that residents and families with loved ones at other facilities may be asking when they will be able to get immunized. We started with staff and residents in long-term care and designated supportive living first, as they are the most vulnerable to severe outcomes. To date, 66% of all the deaths in Alberta have been in these facilities. Vaccines are being offered to residents in mixed sites where some residents are in designated supportive living and others not, but where all residents share space and commingle. Whenever possible, the vaccine is being delivered at the same time to everyone in these facilities. However, in some cases, the vaccine is being administered in separate times due to limited vaccine supply. Alberta Health Services has been reaching out to these facilities, as well as any place where someone may not have been well enough to receive the first dose immunization when they first visited. I know that many other seniors would benefit tremendously from this vaccine. We want to offer them immunization as soon as possible. Unfortunately, we will be receiving fewer doses than we had hoped for over the next few weeks. However, once supply increases, we will be able to expand access and start offering the vaccine to all seniors 75 years or older, no matter where they live. We will also be able to begin offering vaccine to persons 65 years of age and over, living in First Nations communities or Métis settlements. I know it is challenging to have to wait for this to start. While we cannot control the amount of vaccine available, we are working hard to immunize Albertans as safely and effectively as possible. I'd like to end today by noting that it's been a week since in-class learning resumed for schools in our province. As I announced last week, starting today, we are using updated terminology to classify schools with cases of COVID-19. You'll see those changes reflected in the school map online. To date, we have identified 181 cases in 133 schools since classes resumed. This number reflects community transmission, not in-school transmission, and it is important to distinguish between the two. As I mentioned earlier this month, an analysis of all our cases in school-aged children in the September to December time period last year indicated that only about 6% of these cases were determined to have been acquired at school. The current school model in place is largely effective at limiting in-school transmission. However, as cases rise in the community, they also rise in school populations and everywhere else. The protocols in our schools are important as they allow our students, staff, and teachers to experience the benefit of in-person learning.
All right, so that's the latest on the COVID situation in Alberta. And we're going to stay on COVID. We're going to take a short break, but there is a delay in the Pfizer supply. What will that mean for local rollouts? And what will a new hospital in Ontario, the very first hospital in 30 years, what will that mean for the fight against COVID? We'll find out next with the mayor of Vaughan, the city where it's located. Stay with us. All right, let's focus on COVID for a minute. We've seen COVID field hospitals. Now a brand new hospital will delay its full opening and instead kind of be a standby hospital for COVID-19 relief in Ontario. It's called the Cordelucci Vaughan Hospital. It's set to open next month. First hospital to open in Ontario in 30 years. Will act as a resource for hospitals in the province who are overloaded with COVID-19 patients. Now that announcement comes as officials are struggling to respond to the coming delay in the Pfizer vaccines. What will that mean for the supply issue? How do leaders manage the limited resources? Let's bring back the press gallery. Tana McCharles from the Toronto Star is back. We're now joined by Ian Bailey, reporter with the Globe and Mail. And we're also joined as a special guest with Maurizio Bevilacqua. He is the mayor of the city of Vaughan, where the new hospital is located. You may remember him. He was an MP for 12 years. Great to have you, Mayor, and Ian and Tonda back on the show. Mayor Bevilacqua, first of all, the hospital's open. Can you tell us exactly what it will mean in terms of COVID and why it's kind of playing a special role in the crisis?
Well, you have to pivot during these times. You have to be very, very flexible. You're talking about $1.8 billion investment in healthcare in the city of Vaughan. It's a 1.2 million square foot facility with really world-class technology. And we felt that it was very important to be very useful to the province and to the citizens of the province by pivoting and providing a really much-needed capacity. Capacity is really key here. To deal with COVID-19. So you're talking about 185 additional beds, including 35 for critical care beds. This is needed. As you know, the province of Ontario has been hit hard. You know, one thing I mean, I will say about COVID-19 is that we have been, the world has been very good at underestimating its impact. This has been a formidable foe that we have. And whenever we have resources available in our communities, I think that we have to pool them together to bring about positive change to the present crisis.
Tonda, it's pretty remarkable what that says about the state of the crisis. And how are provinces not just dealing with the fallout of COVID, but how are they having to recalibrate on the supply side given the nature of the Pfizer delays?
Yeah, no, look, another thing about hospitals that tells you a lot about how Ontario is doing is that they're still talking to the feds for another two field hospitals. So everybody's struggling. We learned from Ontario today that, in fact, the way that vaccine supply reduction is going to play out is 20% cut in the next week and then an 80% cut the following week. We didn't hear that from the feds. We heard that from the province today. And so that's going to make a significant difference. In Toronto, Metro Toronto, huge cut in the availability of vaccine immediately. We're assured that everything is going to pick up later. But, you know, I think as Mayor Bevilacqua says, you know, everybody has to pool resources now, pool all they can. I think the worrying thing on the hospital side, capacity is great, but if your health workforce is exhausted and has already hit their wall, how do you staff those beds? We didn't get clear answers on that today.
Yeah, and by the way, if things are so bad, you've got portable morgues in places like London, Ontario, Ian, in British Columbia. How is the supply, the Pfizer supply delays impacting the vaccination rollout there?
Well, all we've heard about that from the health minister late last week on Friday, in fact, was that it will have an impact. And the way he put it is less vaccine means less vaccinations. But, you know, as often seems to be the case, we're waiting this afternoon for a briefing from Dr. Bonnie Henry and Adrian Dix on the specific details about what this will mean for vaccination. I think BC is looking at this as sort of a temporary pause before things escalate back up with more vaccine coming in. So is it, we're just sort of waiting to see what you know how this will play out. But certainly on the vaccination side, you know, it's everyone's waiting for some details later this afternoon on what impact this is going to have.
And Evan, we I was just going to say, we already know that, you know, some provinces don't have as bad a problem, but also aren't rolling their vaccines out as quickly as one would might hope. And so I wonder if there aren't discussions behind the scenes about sharing those supplies, like Nova Scotia, Newfoundland. I was looking at their numbers today, and they've only already administered about 40, well, in Nova Scotia's case, only 33% of their vaccines. Is there any talk of them sharing those doses that they haven't used yet to other provinces, which are really, really struggling with the COVID load?
You're hitting something there, Tonda, and I want to ask Mayor Bevilacqua on that. The blame game is just driving people crazy. The provinces have said, hey, there's a shortage. We're not getting enough. Now the delay has really escalated that. On the other side, people are saying, well, if it's such a bad situation, why are there still so many vaccines sitting in a freezer? So what is it? Is there a shortage and a supply problem, or is there a rollout problem and they're just not getting them into people's arms?
Evan, I will tell you that the blame game is not a game that politicians ought to be playing at this point in time. For all intents and purposes, I think that the country is at war with COVID-19, and we can't afford defectors. And what I mean by that is that we have to be pulling together in the same direction. Look, these are uncharted waters for everybody. These are conditions that we've never met before. Not to say that we were not warned decades ago that a global pandemic would take place, but let's face it, it wasn't really taken seriously. And so now we're paying the price for that careless and cavalier attitude of the past. Having said that, now we're building the tracks and trying to move forward in a way that we can deliver on time. There have also been many, many challenges in the reference of refrigeration and then delays. So what I would say is this. We need a lot of patience, a lot of perseverance. We need a lot of strength, and we will get through this. But assume the worst for now. Assume delays. Assume hiccups along the way. And if things get better, then things will, you know, good for us. But the reality is that the underestimation has been quite noticeable, not just here in Canada, but throughout the world.
Yeah, I got to leave it there, but assume the worst. Look, the bottom line is people want more vaccines quickly, and you're looking at other places that are getting them, and that's going to become a political issue as the days go on. And the pain of this continues. Ian Bailey, Tonda McCharles, and Mayor Bevilacqua Vaughan, where the new hospital is going to be dedicated. And again, real sign of where we are right now. Thanks for joining us. And thank all of you for joining us. That is your Power Play Day in Politics. We will be back in 23 short hours. Hug your loved ones if it's safe to do. I know it's a long road. We appreciate you joining us today. Have a great evening. We'll see you tomorrow.